You know, right now we're experiencing a divine reset across the country. What if we took a weekly Sabbath reset?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Friends, we're going to have a special and important broadcast today. I believe it could be life-changing for many of you listening and watching. Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown, and the number to call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. As long as the question is Jewish-related in any way or relates to a topic that I bring up on the show, you are welcome to call with your question. You can just need information. You can want to disagree with me on something. Perfectly fine. 866-34-TRUTH. A little later in the broadcast, since it is April 16th and since we are at the end of Passover, I do want to look at some words that spoke of some major shifts that were going to happen regarding the virus around this time, April 15th, 16th, specifically mid-April has been spoken of. So I want to honestly evaluate that. And then make some larger observations about prophetic ministry today. So we're going to be doing that. But first, I want to start here. I have a new article that is up on the stream and on our website. And the title of the article is this: The Shutdown, the Sabbath, and a Weekly Divine Reset. So we're in this unique season now that none of us have ever lived through before. None of us have ever lived through this season where things are shut down the way they are, as long as they are, and potentially for quite a ways ahead of us. So in a time like this, you want to seize the moment. At a time like this, you want to say, God, what are you saying to us? At a time like this, you want to learn and you want to grow and you want to change wherever you can. I'm reading about people that are known for narcissism and carnality, and they're talking about looking at more important things in life and investing more time in family or deepening their own character. And it's just because normal life with all of its distractions is put on hold. I remember one night some years ago when the internet went out in our house and there was no online content for a period of hours. So that meant no emails coming in and out and no social messaging, media messaging, and no updating posts, no watching anything, no catching up on news, nothing. And I remember that night, just in prayer and reflection, I felt I got more insights from the Lord than normal. I thought, yeah, well, I shut off the distractions. There have been many times in prayer where I'm so aware of, you know, texts on my phone and emails to respond to and something I want to study here that I just have to turn everything off, close the computer, put the phone on silent, and shut the lights and just get on my face alone with God to get quiet, to meditate, to pray more deeply, to focus, to listen more. So we're in a situation where, not by our choice, things have been shut down in unique ways. And quite a few Christian leaders are hearing the same thing. This is time for a divine reset. And it's almost self-evident. You don't have to be a prophet to hear that. Time for a divine reset. Just don't go back to life as normal. My new book, When the World Stops, Words of Faith, Hope, and Wisdom in the Midst of Crisis, that comes out in 5 days, I deal with that. That what is God saying to us in the midst of this? How can we seize this moment? But here's the question. Once life goes back to normal, so to say, once you're at your normal work activities and kids are in their normal school activities, and you have more of the distractions, the restaurants and the movie theaters and the sports arenas and everything else going on, and there's that cycle of life, how do we not fall back into our old habits? And the answer is a regular weekly reset, otherwise known as the Sabbath. Now, my purpose here and in my article is not to say that Sabbath observance is mandatory for all Christians in terms of a specific day, as opposed to finding Sabbath rest in the Messiah and other debates we could have. nor am I debating whether the Sabbath must be kept on Saturday, whether Christians can keep it on Sunday, or does any day do. Not getting into that debate. Those are all important subjects, all worthy of discussion, but not where I'm going today. Let me read some quotes to you. Perhaps the man who authored the most famous contemporary book on the Sabbath is the Jewish thinker, the late Abraham Joshua Heschel. And he referred to Sabbath as a sanctuary in time. And he said that the Sabbaths are our great cathedrals. He said they are the Jewish equivalent of sacred architecture. So what did he mean? The Sabbaths are our great cathedrals, the Jewish equivalent of sacred architecture. Well, he said that one of the most distinguished words in the Bible is the word kadosh, holy, a word which more than any other is representative of the mystery and majesty of the divine. He says, now, what was the first holy object in the history of the world? What is it? Was it a mountain? Was it an altar? Yeah, it's a good question. What's the first thing in the Bible that God called holy? Heschel answers, it is indeed a unique occasion at which the distinguished word kadosh is used for the first time. In the book of Genesis, at the end of the story of creation, how extremely significant is the fact that it is applied to time, and God blessed the seventh day and made it holy. There is no reference in the record of creation to any object in space that would be endowed with the quality of holiness. So when God made the whole world and the human race, he said it was good. Then he said it was very good, but he didn't say it was holy, set apart for the divine in that same way. But when he rested from his labors, he called the seventh day holy. And Heschel is saying that when we enter into that, we enter into a sanctuary in time, not a physical sanctuary, but a sanctuary in time, and in that place encounter God, encounter holiness on a deeper level. And one of the things that happens is it is supposed to be a time for reset, for refreshing, for renewal, for recharging, for reinvigorating. You stop, you rest on some level, you cease from normal labors on some level. Now, obviously, If you've got four little kids at home, you know, ages four, twins at two, and then a six-month-old, that the Sabbath is still a time when there are things you have to do, all right? But to the extent we can pull away from other things, to the extent that we can make time to rest and recharge and reflect and step back and look at life, okay, what really matters? How am I spending my time? What's really important? And get God's perspective. To that extent, we live lives that are different. Let me read another quote here. This is from Cheryl Miller in her book on the Sabbath titled Rhythms of Rest. She said, rest provides fine tuning for hearing God's messages amidst the static of life. So let me read that again. She said, rest provides fine tuning for hearing God's messages amidst the static of life. Now, look, you may need to have a situation, just like couples have date nights and things like this. You may, if you're busy parents, work out a schedule where, say, dad, you give your wife a certain time. It could be one night, where she doesn't have to think about anything. You bring in dinner to eat. She doesn't have to cook. Dishes, just fast food stuff, whatever, healthy. Okay, just throw out stuff when it's done, or you take care of the cleaning, everything, and you're going to take care of the kids. And she can just get in a room for a few hours and worship or read or rest, just what she wants to do to recharge. When our kids were growing up, So I was working a full-time job and then in grad school as well, so busy, and then doing some ministry within our church. But we would work things out so that certain time of the day, like on a Saturday, that I'd just be taking care of the kids, and Nancy could go out and do things that she just wanted to do to just be on her own a little bit and just not have other cares. And if whatever was best going to suit her, it would be a good, healthy time for her. we may not be able to do everything in the same structured Sabbath way, all right? And obviously, we don't have all the traditions that Judaism has, which if you're raised with them can be beautiful. If you're coming from the outside, they can often seem oppressive, you know, Sabbath traditions and things like that. But either way, consider the idea of divine reset. Consider the idea of regular stepping back. I have pastor friends who once a month will go away for a full day just to get alone with the Lord, just them and their Bible, and just pray and worship and read the Word and do it for a day. I have friends who will take 1 month at the beginning of the year and get off all social media and just pull back and spend more time seeking the face of God. You know, I was looking at my schedule at the end of the year for our board. My assistant Dylan will just put together, okay, here's when you're out speaking and numbers of trips and different things like this. So at the end of last year, I looked at it, I thought, whoa, that's more than I want to be on the road. I mean, on the road, between traveling and speaking, 200 days or more, plus doing the daily radio show. Yeah, so sometimes having to do it on the road, daily radio show, 5 days a week. Then we published 5 books last year. And then I wrote more than 250 articles. And then we produced more than 450 videos, including the daily radio show. I looked at all that and thought, I need to slow down. Oh, I'm not tired, not burnt out, actually thriving. But I thought, that's too much time traveling. I need more time being, more time in the presence of God, more time stopping and reflecting and studying and deepening and sharpening my pen as I write. One of my friends went to Wheaton College, Wheaton University now, decades ago, and there was a professor there who literally scheduled out every hour of his week. And he came into class one day all excited. He said, yesterday, it turns out I had 1 hour free unexpectedly, so I just did something spontaneous. He said, and it was so amazing. I'm going to schedule 1 hour a week for spontaneity. Scheduled spontaneity. Well, how about we schedule one day a week or one season in the week, one segment of time for renewal, for stepping back, for reset, for reflection, for taking stock. I believe if we do, it will be life-changing, and it's one of the reasons that God gave Israel the Sabbath. All right, we'll be right back. Your Jewish-related calls are welcomed, 866-34-TRUTH, and then I want to candidly discuss some questions about prophetic ministry today. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to the Line of Fire. Thanks so much for joining us. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. 866-34-TRUTH on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I'm going to go to the phones shortly. Any Jewish-related question you have, be my joy to answer. All right, we are now at April 16th. We are now in the middle of this month. We are now at the end of the Passover season. And this was a time when different prophetic leaders today said that there would be a shift, that we would come to the end of the first phase of dealing with the virus and be entering a second phase, where there would be a diminishing. And before that, there were other prophetic voices basically saying this is not going to touch America, or this is not going to be as bad as everyone is saying. All right, it seems right now that those words were wrong, that those words were not accurate or not correct. Now, I say it seems right now because it's possible that later today, President Trump is going to say, okay, we've just finished the first phase, and now we're about to make changes in our policies, and we believe that the peak deaths have been reached and things are going down from here, and we're now instituting policies about change, this and that. And then we'll look back and say, wow, the shift came in mid-April. But at this point, from this vantage point, especially words saying that nothing was going to touch America or that it would be minimal or that this is not as bad as everyone is saying, it appears at this point that those words were not accurate. Okay, now I want to say a bunch of things here. Number one, some could say, look, there were predictions about tens of millions of dying. I saw one prediction from someone who had been in the Obama administration saying that 15 million Americans could die. And then others were talking about multiplied tens of millions worldwide. So if we end up with a couple hundred thousand deaths, then obviously it's nowhere near what some were predicting. Even the predictions about America have been brought way down, way down, way down. But that could be because of the radical measures that have been taken. Now, there's a debate about that. Some say the radical measures are not making the difference. The difference is coming for other reasons. But either way, if the words were specifically spoken in context about people are saying it's going to be multiplied tens of millions who die, and it's not going to be anywhere near that, it's not going to be a fraction of what people are saying, well, if we end up with a few hundred thousand deaths, that would be true. However, as I heard the words initially, it was that it would not be going on this long, that the casualties would not be what they are right now. And therefore, I would say those words are not accurate. Those words were false. Now, words about things happening in the middle of April, at this moment, they don't look accurate either. We may see, as I said, looking back a few weeks from now, or as news breaks over the rest of the day, there may be some reasons to say, oh, there was something to it, because the words didn't say it's going to end here or stop here, but it's going to be the end of one phase, the beginning of another, and a clear diminishing. So we shall still see. But at this point, there's nothing dramatic that's happened as of now. There's nothing dramatic that's happened in the society as of now. You say, oh, so they're false prophets. No, no, no. False prophets, according to Jesus in Matthew 7, are ravenous wolves in sheep's clothing. They are not servants of God who said something that was not accurate. All right? They are not men of God who love the Lord and otherwise preach the gospel of Jesus and say something not accurate. Did they prophesy falsely? At this point, it looks like the answer is yes. You say, oh, so then you don't believe anything they have to say. Ah, here's where we have our difference. I believe right now that the critics are right in exposing a lot of our charismatic prophecy as being off and unreliable. On the flip side, they are absolutely wrong in rejecting prophetic ministry today. It's a question of the purpose of prophetic ministry. Now, if God wanted to warn us about something to come, like in Acts the 11th chapter, Agabus has a word about famine coming. And the believers hear it, the apostles, the others, they hear it, and they conclude, okay, based on this, we need to take up an offering to help the poor saints in Jerusalem, because if famine's coming, there's going to be hardship, and they're often hit the worst. There was a practical reason for it, so there would be a certain response. But otherwise, there's no indication in the New Testament that before God does something in the earth that he has to tell his prophets. You say, yeah, but Amos 3 says that God won't do anything without revealing his secret to his servants, the prophets. That was an Old Testament reality. Now in the New Testament, we are a prophetic people, and the purpose of prophecy in many ways has shifted. Did God seem to give words to a number of different people in unusual ways about Donald Trump becoming president? Yes. And it got a lot of attention in advance, and I believe God was speaking it. The unlikelihood of it, the way it happened, the people that received it, a whole list of things would make me say, yeah, God was doing that maybe because it was such a strange and unlikely thing that Trump would be a pro-life champion or strong for Israel or strong for our religious rights, that it was getting our attention. But let's also be candid. There have been other words that said Romney was going to be elected. Now, they didn't come the same way. It seemed more just wishful thinking, which is why everything must be tested. New Testament prophecy is different than Old Testament prophecy. New Testament prophecy is two or three speak, 1 Corinthians 14, and then the others weigh carefully. They weigh it to seek to discern. No, we don't. We feel that was the Lord, or that was a mixture of what God was saying or what you were saying. The same with 1 Thessalonians 5. Paul gives directives. Don't despise prophecy. He also gives a directive. Don't put out the Spirit's fire. What do? Test everything and hold fast to the good. We don't stone someone who gets it wrong. We simply say, okay, you've hurt your credibility. and we do not make decisions on a prophet saying, thus and such is going to happen, you better all move out of this area before the earthquake comes. Unless that person has had striking accuracy for years and years on a national level, it's just, well, God can speak to me. I'm his child. God can speak directly to any of us. We're his children. You say, well, Mike, why are you making excuses? I'm not making excuses. I'm saying that words that have been spoken thus far, some of them seem to be plainly wrong, and some, unless something very clear is shifting in these days that will be very obvious in the days ahead, words spoken about time frame today, those are also wrong. At the same time, some of those people seem to have received accurate information about other things going on today. And more importantly, for every one example of one of these prophetic brothers or sisters getting something wrong or not seeing what was coming, you know, gathering at the end of the year and praying, what do we see coming for the next year, and not getting a lot of it right. For every example of that, there are probably 50 or 100 or 1,000 or 5,000 examples of specific words they had into specific situations and specific lives that have been incredibly, mind-bogglingly, Jesus-glorifyingly accurate. And I'm an eyewitness to many of these things, and some have happened in my own life, and here and there some have happened through me. I mean, shockingly accurate. I mean, amazingly accurate. There's a young man that I know that worked as an administrator for a large charismatic ministry. And if you ask me, give me a list of 1,000 people that you think would do well in Washington, that work with senators and governors and have access to key leaders, and who do you think would be? If you asked me for 1,000 names, 5,000 names, 10,000 names, I would not have put this fellow's name on the list. I would not have. Well, I lose touch with him for a while. I run into him in D.C., and he's a suit and tie. I've never seen him in anything but a jeans and T-shirt. Suit and tie. What's with the suit and tie? He's just gotten off the phone with several governors as they're planning about doing something together. He's working with so-and-so's presidential campaign. It's like, what in the world? And he said, oh, yeah. This one well-known prophetic sister, he said, she had a word over me. You need to buy 3 suits because you're going to Washington and you're going to work in D.C. and you're going to work with congressmen. And I mean, a specific word. And then immediately after that, someone calls him and says, God just told me to buy you 3 suits for, I mean, crazy stuff like that. Example after example after example after example after example I can give you. Here's one that I have in my book, Playing with Holy Fire. There's a prophetic brother at a home Bible study. There's a woman there at the Bible study, and he gets a word for her. Say to her, from the Lord, God says to you, I hate mommies and daddies. What? That's unscriptural. Honor your father and mother. What? Well, obviously it meant something else. He felt compelled to speak it to her. So he did, and she began to break down weeping and received a significant emotional healing in her life. As a girl growing up, her father would come into her room and sexually abuse her and say, we're going to play mommies and daddies. And then he would sexually abuse her. It traumatized her life. Those of you who've been subject to childhood sexual abuse, you can relate. I can't imagine what the horror would be like. It traumatized her, even though she was a believer, she had these deep emotional scars. And here this prophetic brother hears the Lord to say something very unusual, very unexpected, and God tells her, I was there, and I hated what you were going through, and it set her free, and it changed her life. One of my colleagues, who's very critical about a lot of the prophetic stuff happening today, went to investigate one of the brothers who had a word about a shift coming in mid-April, and he was critical and questioning things, and he said, well, I looked into one client. He had a word over a woman in a service with scoliosis and told her she was about to be healed and so on. Lifelong condition, right? And had a word over her. He said, so I found out who it was. I got her name. I called her. He said, I have amazing news for her. She's completely healed. The word changed her life. She's healed. And so these things are happening day and night. Prophetic ministry is real and beautiful and wonderful, and God is doing it. And it is thoroughly scriptural, and we should embrace it. At the same time, I do not believe the primary purpose of New Testament prophetic ministry, we discussed the same thing yesterday on the air with Jeremiah Johnson, is predicting the future, especially for our abstract information or to prove that God knows it. When he wants us to hear something, he'll speak it and we'll know it. So I'm saying let's get in our right lane. When we use it rightly, it's amazing and God glorifying. And every so often, we'll speak on a national level or an international level with a warning or word. But otherwise, we are not primarily just getting the news about what's going to happen tomorrow. And to the extent we try to do that, we're going to mess up. That's my take.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Music from Israel. Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-34-TRUTH. So we were scheduled to do our next tour in Israel in May. And we had two buses. That was our limits, about 100 people, and basically everything filled. For some months, we were very close to capacity. And now we've had to reschedule it, and we have dates locked in for October. And a bunch of folks, because of the change in schedule, they're not going to be free in October or maybe just needed their refunds because of the life situation. But we had a bunch of cancellations, which means that, God willing, we will have openings for our tour in October. It's still a long ways off, but since it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, I thought I'd mention it to you. If you want to go to Israel, and or we're trusting that life will be back to normal in the positive sense by then this would be a great time to go. October is an awesome time to be in Israel. All right, to the phones. Let's start with Troy in Kentucky. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air. You're on the air, sir. All right, team, are we having the same problem with the phones that we had the other day? Could someone do a quick check on that? Make sure everything is set properly. We had some errors a couple times in the last week. Hopefully got those kinks straightened out. Let's see. Let's go to Ricky in Nebraska. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air. All right, tell you what, I'm so sorry, folks. Guys, can you figure out, please, what our error is so that we can get our callers on here? It seems that they're not hearing me. Well, I'm hearing them, but they are not hearing me. So here's what we're going to do. Troy, I'm going to bring you back on, and when you come on, you don't. If you don't hear my voice, don't worry about it. You just start asking your questions. Let's try this again. All right, Troy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, Dr. Brown. Yes. So I have a question, but I first wanted to thank you. I'm a Christian, and your books equipped me very well. Last September, I was in Jerusalem for my brother's wedding, and I actually met Tovia Singer on the street, and I was able to defend my faith. We had a discussion there. So I thank you for your books and your the resources that you provided there. On the other hand, I have a question. I'm planning on having a discussion with another rabbi this coming following week. And I've prepared a little bit on my own, but I wanted to ask you what you would have to say to his position. So his position is he believes that only the five books of Moses are what we can base doctrine on. Everything else is commentary, even the prophets. And so because of that position, he basically tries to nullify the Christian argument that there's an exclusive need for Yeshua, for faith in Yeshua. He believes we can just unite on, you know, keeping the commandments together, but he nullifies the need for Yeshua because it's not explicitly required in the Torah. So my question is, how would you go about refuting that position?
Right. What kind of rabbi is he?
He's Rabbi Asher Meza.
Ah, okay. So what would be the purpose in dialoguing with him?
To debate him, to reason with him. I'm a Christian, so I would want to debate him and, you know, share the gospel, but ultimately refute his position. And so I was wanting your I was wanting to ask you how you would do. So I have a few points in my own studies that I've come up with, but I wanted to ask you how you would refute that position.
Yeah, so I'll answer that. I've had Usher Mays on the air a few times. We've interacted. He's interacted with thousands of people. He has no interest in hearing your viewpoint, but rather convincing you of his viewpoint. In other words, it's not like, hey, let's have a conversation because he's open to hear your viewpoint any more than Tovia Singer would want to be. So I don't know, unless you just wanted to do it as a learning experience, what the purpose would be. It would be like, you know, someone wanting, a new Jehovah's Witness wants to talk to me. It's like, well, if you want to talk to me to see how your position gets demolished, I'm happy to demolish your position. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to persuade me of anything. I'll try to help you. That would be his view towards you. You know what I'm saying? He's heard the arguments. He's discussed all these things for many, many years. And his goal is to make proselytes and push in a certain direction. So in your mind, what would be the purpose of the conversation?
Yeah, the purpose is not to have an entirely new conversation he's never had. But the purpose is, a lot of his debates, he'll challenge Christians on that issue. And there are certain responses that I feel like I would make that would sort of challenge him. But I feel like often, you know, like his position doesn't really get challenged well. It's just so my purpose would be to go on to give some points that maybe other Christians that he's argued with haven't made, to try to challenge and like put a rock in his shoe to challenge his position, which I haven't heard done very well yet.
Yeah, I mean, feel free to do it. It's just when you're dealing with professionals in terms of this is what they do day and night, they're just, it's like a spider with a fly. In other words, all you're doing is coming in their web. I mean, I've told people for decades, with people like Tovia Singer, you know, militant counter-missionaries, like, pray for them. It's best thing you can do is pray for them, because they've dealt with people who can demolish their arguments and they still don't listen. So all the time I've spoken with Asher Meza and felt very clearly his arguments were weak and wrong, he's still going on doing what he's doing. You know, so I want you to understand honestly that it's going to be a learning experience more than anything, as opposed to that you're going to be able to really get him to think differently. But if I was dealing with him, first, the claim that the five books are all we have. Within the five books, you know, Deuteronomy 18, God speaks of raising up a prophet. So that indicates God's going to continue to speak and the people are supposed to listen to the prophets. And say, well, who is that? Where are those prophets or that one prophet? I would raise that. I would say, well, the vast majority of what's commanded there, you can't do. You have to build the tabernacle, doesn't mention the physical temple, tabernacle, and sacrifices. So the vast majority of what's required there, you can't do.